tonight on Arena. Anda Walsh on Touch, his new short film for the RTE Illuminations project, and Jess Fahey and Sarah Wilson on How to Read a Painting. Double 51 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Playwright and screenwriter Enda Walsh has brought together a great group of creative collaborators for his contribution to RTE's Illuminations project, which offers artists a platform for their creative response to the pandemic. In the short film Touch, Enda explores what it is to be alone and to be isolated, and the role played by our own mishmash of memories at a time like this. The piece is performed, voiced by Rosalind Lenihan, with visuals from Jack Phelan and music score from Irene Buckley. And delighted to have Enda Walsh join us from London. I presume you're in this evening. Enda, how has lockdown been?
Oh, it's well, personally, it's been I've been finding it really difficult, I must say. I wasn't too good. I had a commission for Netflix that finished, I think, in April, and then all my sort of theatre work was obviously sort of cancelled. And but yeah, I'm ashamed to say I've just found it really, really difficult.
It's funny because a lot of writers, ironically, have said that to me, because we often think, oh, well, for sure, writers, this is perfect. They're well used to the isolation of the lonely garret, et cetera, et cetera. But seemingly not.
I think sort of the thing about it is, I think you do, you write for an audience. I mean, I'm a playwright and I've written a couple of sort of films, and you do write for an audience. And when the audience aren't there, it's a bit like, well, actually, what is my purpose? I mean, things began to sort of change as the months went on last year. And by the end of the year, I felt as if, and the noises from producers about this year, no matter what has to happen is, you know, the work has to go on, and you know, whether it's sort of it's streamed live every night, and there's a certain amount of people are allowed in the auditorium. They need to sort of, you know, create the work. So coming into this year, I felt as if, well, fine, you know, I'll get to do that.
And then this Thank year God. Started. Let's say nothing more about that.
This year started.
Let's keep our fingers crossed that it can only get better from here on in. But yeah. The Illuminations project then, when it came along, and this idea of responding to the pandemic in some way, that must have been a welcome idea.
It was, and I was approached by Teresa Kelly and Vanessa Gilday, and the response was to this year, and I wanted to write something, I guess. I wanted to make something about people in care and old people in care, and this sort of lack of touch and all of that. And I found that just really sort of cripplingly sort of sad. And in writing it, I ended up very quickly just writing about my mom, who died of Alzheimer's a few years ago. And the piece has become this, I guess, this conversation. It's a mix of my memories and my mother's memories. And so it's like just deeply personal and filled with family memories and all the rest.
Yeah, because I was wondering when I saw it first, I thought dedicated to Maeve Walsh. There's obviously a relationship there, so it is your mum that you were talking about in that dedication. So, and Rosalind Lenihan then is the voice that we hear, because again I had wondered, oh, is the Donegal accent? Did yourself and Rosalind discuss that, or is there a Donegal connection for your mother?
I think it's sort of a Donegal connection for Rosalind, obviously, and I worked with Rosalind before, and you know, and I wanted her to write it, and so I pitched it for a combination of, you know, you're always trying to ask your collaborators to reach into their past and to sort of drag out, you know, pieces of them, and so there is as much of, you know, I think in the sort of sensibility of how sort of Rosalind went at it and her memories, I guess, of her own, you know, father and, you know, and parents and their marriage and her placement in her sort of family of sisters and all the rest. So it became Donegal for that reason.
Yeah, I guess that's how the personal becomes something else totally, where it starts with you, your mother, it expands into Rosaline and her parents, and then
I think particularly sort of Sean, you know sort of what it's like, but particularly I think this year and the way we're making work at the moment, where we're individually sort of, you know, we're not in a room creating it together, we're all in our little sort of pods creating it, so it's I felt as if, and in the making of it, I had very, very minimal sort of direction with my collaborators, Jack Phelan, who did the visuals, and Irene Buckley. There were really just small conversations, and really it was for them to meditate on what I was sort of suggesting in the script, and allow people in their own way just fold in back into their own lives and see what came out. So it was a really strange process in that it was very, very little direction. It came in, we stuck it together, and there it was.
Well, let's have a listen to a section from the opening of the film, in fact, and the voice that we will hear here, Rosaline Linehan.
Mammy's hands are like a wall, where noises ebb to near nothing. The murmur of the town is distant. The slow breeze stands at the window, asking her, I think. It looks in at her and me. It lightens and marks us, that breeze. And it begins. The kitchen table, and unseated I am, cause still baby-sized, and passed between the eaters and talkers. A landscape of spuds and butter beneath me. Thank God. The front room then, and held by my daddy on his lap. Work tired, and the bitter smell of cigarettes on his seat and on him. The itchiness of his day. The worry of sons and daughters to keep. I curl into him and wish him rest.
So an opening sequence there from Enda Walsh's short film. Even just listening to it there, I have to tell you, I watched it about three or four times, one after another today, because I found it totally mesmerising and brought me on this beautiful journey. As you say, I suddenly, you know, I don't have a background in Donegal, but all of the things that were expressed, you know, on my daddy on his lap, the itchiness of his day, you know, this idea of being at a big table where the grown-ups were doing something you could barely see over the top of it, all that type of thing. It's amazing how universal these tiny little details are.
Yeah, they are. I mean, they certainly are. And I mean, all you have to do is just, I mean, you concentrate on your own child and you throw it out there and you feel as if we have, you know, I mean, we've covered a lot of ground, you know, as people, as children. And it became a sort of strange thing, I must say, Sean, of like, my mom had Alzheimer's for 7 years, but it was a way in actually sort of writing it and of connecting with them and allowing that person actually sort of, accept their sort of death and all of that, but in a really sort of very sad sort of nostalgic way. And and the hope that actually sort of her memories and her death were possibly that, I think.
Yeah, well, it certainly keeps her very alive in terms of those memories. And they don't have to be exactly what she went through or anything like that, because I guess that's not what you're getting at. It's not, let me tell my mother's life story. That's not what you're doing.
I think so many of them are mine as well. So I can hear a lot of, you know, me in there and all the rest.
I don't know whether it's necessity being the mother of invention, but, you know, Rosaline working by herself and doing the voice recording, I think it was her son Connor who actually did the recording with her. He's involved in the music world, so it would make sense that he'd be able to do that side of things. Irene doing her side of things totally separate from all of that, and Jack Phelan, Irene Buckley, the composer, Jack Phelan. It's amazing how despite the fact that things were so disparate in the making of them,
yeah,
they don't sound like that or look like that at all.
No, they don't. They don't. I mean, it was a real sort of lesson to myself, I must say, because, you know, when I'm in the room and I'm directing the work in the room, it's you have to sort of remind yourself that actually you have to allow your collaborators in. You have to allow them create. It's the reason why you do it. And I think back to my own work and I think, oh my God, I better be careful now. Maybe I'm actually sort of, I'm standing on a lot of feet here or sort of talking over people. You have to sort of allow them into the work. And that's why I wanted to, I mean, I in a million years couldn't come up with the sort of visuals that Jack decided. A conversation was had about how we remember the past and nostalgia because it's given to us by film in sort of soft focus or black and white, these sort of flashbacks. And Jack was actually sort of, he came up with probably a true representation of actually what our memories are like, that they come in a very abstracted, broken, splintered way.
Yeah, it almost starts like, I'm not going to do justice to the visuals, but it starts as if it's some kind of a journey down a corridor, which could be in an institution, given what you were talking about, you know, in terms of your mother having Alzheimer's and care homes, etc. But very, very soon, it becomes this kind of fantastical, magically lit kind of world where anything is possible. But all the time, a sense of this constant, like a big, long tracking shot that goes on for the, whatever it is, 7.5 or 8 minutes of the piece.
I know. It's I think that was my one note to him. I think there's a lot of corridors in this piece, and that's all I had. That's all I brought to the table. But that just seemed to me like a good starting point, and you know, and that we're traveling up, you know, through it.
Yeah, and similarly with Irene Buckley's score to the piece as well.
Yeah.
And again, I don't mean this as any disservice to Irene, because obviously within a score, the moments of silence are as important as the moments of non-silence, let us say. There is a point in the score when the music just fades to nothing.
Yeah.
And it's
I know.
Go ahead.
I know she's an absolutely huge talent. I mean, I've been a fan of hers for a couple of years, and she's young still for a composer, but it's really, really exciting that I think she's going to have a huge career in film, I must say, if she wants to have that, because her sensibility around the sort of subject is really quite beautiful. And
again,
they create it. I mean, when people sort of see it, it feels sort of large and spatial and huge, and yet the content of what the character is saying, a lot of it is very sort of small and personal, and something that I think we know as people, these tiny, tiny memories that just sort of pop up in our lives.
It doesn't sound as if the lockdown was so bad after all now when we get this far into the conversation, does it?
Well, listen. I said to sort of Teresa and Vanessa, this was really wonderful therapy for me, and I should have really given them a lot of money for it, so I'm very happy.
Yeah. Well, no, it certainly is a beautiful piece and available on the RTE website. I mean, the Illumination, if you go on looking for Illuminations, you'll find it there. But there has other stuff been happening. Are we going to get Medicine? This is the new play. You've been working on that. Is that pretty much complete at this stage? Are we going to get a production? Or dare you say that without crossing every finger you have?
I think we are. I think no matter what, I think the sort of deal is that we're going to sort of make it. I mean, it's playing in Galway and then going to the International Edinburgh Festival, and then there's talk of New York and all the rest. And I think we're gonna make it with Donald Gleeson and Aoife Duffin and Claire Barrett. Yeah.
So that's written and done at this point.
Yes.
What? Yeah. Where do you see? You know, I know this is in some ways it's an impossible question. How long is a piece of string? But if we can't get to a point where we can get back into theatres, if we're still in some kind of very limited aspect to things, do we have to rethink everything we thought about theatre, or do we just have to be patient?
I think we have to be, I do think we have to be patient. And I think, you know, I mean, things mightn't get back to sort of, you know, how things were this year. It might be sort of next year by the time. And I think, you know, but I think people are they're wanting to see, and they're buying these sort of streamed, you know, performances, and they're wanting to see the arts continue. They care about it and all the rest, and you know, people will sort of like. I mean, we did a staged performance. It was only a reading book in hand, but on its feet of Medicine in the Galway Arts Festival this year. We were so lucky to do it for about sort of 50, 75 people in a room. And that seemed like enough. It seemed like, for me, it was enough. It was, but also the audience just adored the fact that here they were, this sort of like, it was live, it was wild, it was on its feet, and, you know, it was, I don't know. I do think, yeah, we have to be sort of patient with ourselves and not to be sort of too hard. And when it comes to actually sort of making the work that the theatre is, I think they need to sort of respond by with new work and with new writing. And, you know, I mean, theatre is, I think in Ireland, is very sort of, I find it, you know, in really, really good shape. And it'd be terrible shame to sort of go back. But I think that, you know, to just, you know, the canon and the old work and all that type of thing. But I think artistic directors get that. You know, we come out of this sort of pandemic, we want to sort of respond, maybe not sort of directly about it and have plays about the pandemic and da-da-da-da-da. But there's something, I mean, playwrights and theatre makers will make work, you know, that captures some sort of wild energy or sort of our expression of, you know, something else, or will respond to that in a sort of, you know, opaque, sort of oblique way or whatever. Or maybe talk about it directly. But they need to actually sort of produce the sort of the new work, which I think they will.
Yeah, I suppose in the midst of all of that, we have the difficulty of, for particularly those who are involved at the coalface, if you like, who are standing out on the stages night after night. There is no stage to go and stand out on night after night. What kind of support, you know, from talking to actors, from talking to technicians who work behind the scenes, and there's nothing for them to be a technician on at the moment. What sort of supports do you hear them looking for, and what sort of supports do you think would help them in this current situation?
Well, I can only talk from it. So the team and the large sort of team that I work with and that we've made work with, and, you know, and they've got sort of families to, you know, keep and all that. So they're finding employment anywhere. Mm. I mean, absolutely anywhere to sort of keep things going. And they all sort of, you know, they work for themselves, and there's no sort of funding over here, you know, to help them in Britain anyway, you know, they're all sort of self-employed.
Yeah, you can't furlough yourself, I presume.
You cannot furlough yourself. So, I mean, you know, you're eating into your savings, but also, the team I know, I mean, they're going off and just getting work anywhere, any sort of work, and knowing and hoping, you know, that actually sort of things will begin to... But they're like international sort of, you know, creators of work. So there's theatre opening up in, you know, different places, and hopefully they'll get work there and da-da-da-da. But we just got to sort of hold our nerve and, you know, and go, it will sort of, and try and get by and go, you know, well... You know, it's what we've sort of, it's our work and it's our life, and it will come, you know, and it will sort of, you know, it will happen again, and people will want to see sort of, I mean, I miss bands and, you know, theatre and dance and all that type of thing. It reminds me of, you know, that people are capable of doing sort of like extraordinary things and expressing things in such amazing ways. So, you know, it's all of that. You're right. We need to be sort of patient and sort of, and not too hard on ourselves. Yeah. Is the thing.
Well, okay. Listen, I want to finish up with a track from Lazarus, the musical you worked on with David Bowie,
great.
Obviously back in 2015. It was put out online, wasn't it, for around the time of the birthday was January the 8th, of course, and the anniversary of the death, January the 10th. You were quite happy for it to be up there online. This is an online version of the stage musical.
Yeah, I was. I was sort of. I was asked about a month ago about it, and I said yes, not thinking about it. But then I realized that, you know, tens of thousands of people have watched it, and it's great. I mean, I must say, it's sort of it's shot and sounds, you know, brilliant. So I'm chuffed. Yeah.
Well, I'm going to finish up with the section then from Lazarus, where Heroes is performed. How would you lead us into this, Enda?
Oh, it's another release, and it's another death, but it's a very sort of happy one, that's for sure. And
All right. Well, listen, lovely to speak with you, Enda, and I hope that
you too, Sean.
We'll be talking about something on a stage somewhere very soon, and that we can enjoy that conversation as much, certainly, as I have, and I'm sure the listeners have, with you over the last 20 minutes. Take care, Enda. All the best.
Thanks, Sean. Thanks.
And Walsh. And here is Heroes in that version from Enda's Lazarus.
Oh, we can be heroes. just for one day.
Voices there of Michael C. Hall and Thomas Jerome Newton singing Heroes from Lazarus, that Enda Walsh collaboration with David Bowie. And Enda Walsh speaking to us about his short film Touch, written and directed by Enda, starring Rosalind Linehan, the music of Irene Buckley, visuals of Jack Phelan. It can be found on the RTE Illuminations website. 28 minutes past 7 on Wednesday night's Arena. January, not to mind January in lockdown, is a good time to take up a new hobby or an interest. Art appreciation is one of those interests that can be both exciting but a bit daunting. Now, what we're talking about here is the ability to look at a painting or a sculpture with knowledge and in so doing gain more satisfaction from the work. The National Gallery is starting an online course tomorrow, but we decided to ask our own two art experts, Jessica Fahey and Sarah Wilson, to pick a few paintings from the National Gallery collection and tell us how we might approach reading the intention of the artist and understanding the period in which they worked. I'll start with you, Jessica, because you're going to be part of this this course, in fact, in the National Gallery starting tomorrow. What exactly is involved in reading a painting?
So there's quite a few different ways of doing it, which I think is what makes it so exciting. So some people would be interested more in formalist concerns or the materials, so exactly what it looks like, how it's made. And then other people are more interested in the social context of, you know, how it was created, who it was created for, or the context of the artist. So we have all of these different avenues to explore with any given artwork, which allows us to, you know, kind of focus in on certain areas or try and, you know, zoom out from it and see what we can learn about the time in which it was created. So we use the artwork as evidence sometimes as well.
And I guess the first thing, the simple thing we have to do is, what are we looking at? What exactly is it?
Exactly, that's the key. So you just stand in front of it and you think you may know what you're looking at, but when you have to start, you know, putting it into words and describing it, you all of a sudden start to realize more details. You start to notice specific things about the choices that the artist made that might be significant. And over enough, you know, time of looking at other paintings, you kind of train your eye to it. And of course, you can also read and, you know, study it in order to put together kind of almost like an argument for the painting or for the evidence that you're finding within the painting.
And also there are other more formal things like composition that we might look at in the history of the patron. Did anybody, you know, ask for this painting to be made? But we maybe talk about those couple of things in the specifics of the paintings that yourself and Sarah are going to speak about with us now. Sarah, in fact, you picked three paintings from the National Gallery collection. One of its monumental paintings, The Marriage of Strongbow and Eva by Daniel MacLeish, Grief by Jack B. Yeats, but we're going to start with the European Fra Angelico. And just, if you are, if you're on Twitter and you can get yourself near a phone while you're listening to us now or some kind of device, we'll actually tweet up the images that we're talking about so you can follow the sort of the guidelines that Sarah and Jessica are giving us. But we're starting, as I said then, Sarah, with Fra Angelico, Saints Cosmas and Damien and their brothers surviving at the stake. doesn't sound like a nice place to be. I suppose starting with the idea that Jessica just gave us there, the first step is, well, what are we looking at? Give us the description of what it is.
Absolutely. You want to describe what you see. So this is a very small little piece. It's only about 37 by 46 centimetres, just a little bit over those dimensions. And we're looking at a number of figures gathered in an outdoor piazza. And in the foreground, there's a group of people with halos. We'll notice as well that the halos are stuck to the back of their heads like a CD, and they're tied together in a circle. Two of these men are almost identical, and they're surrounded by flames. But what makes this really interesting is that the flames of the fire actually tend to bend away from the halo wearers, and it's sort of threatening the other figures who are standing around the fire. And all of this is being watched by a row of very well-dressed people up on a balcony in the upper section of the painting. So between the halos, the twin brothers, this sort of failed martyrdom by fire, all of this together lets us know that we're looking at a Christian narrative scene of the failed martyrdom of Cosimos and Damian. And Cosimos and Damian were 3rd century AD Christian physicians living in Asia Minor, which is modern day Turkey, during the Diocletian persecutions. And what happened was they refused to sacrifice to the pagan gods of the Roman Empire. So the Roman consul, who is our very importantly dressed central figure on the balcony, orders their execution. Because we have to remember that the Roman Empire was an enormously vast province, but vast empire, and it was very important that there was a central focus, that everyone was worshipping at the same time, was worshipping the same object. So for someone to say that they weren't going to worship the pagan gods was a big problem. So naturally, this results in the execution of a number of Christians. Right. So God, they attempt to burn them alive. God intervenes, turns the flames away from the Christians and towards their persecutors. Of course, though, as tends to happen in a lot of these martyrdom stories, after the more creative way of death fails, the persecutors come back and say, well, we'll away. Just chop your heads off.
Right, fair enough. So I suppose Sarah touching on telling us exactly what's involved in describing what's in front of our eyes, Jessica, but we need to start looking a little bit further than that. And this is where the reading of the painting comes into play, really, and maybe our history of the period and the type of techniques that Fra Angelico is using here in the painting.
Absolutely. So as Sarah mentioned, it's a very small scale painting and it's very beautifully painted in these very bright colours. One of the things that we kind of know about, you know, particularly 15th century Florentine art is that quite a few of the painters would have trained as illuminators, so manuscript illuminators. This is true of Fra Angelico. So he would have learned those skills of painting on a very, very minute scale. And you can kind of just at a glance of your eye see the similarity between the type of colour and the type of brushwork used between, you know, this work and manuscript. The other thing is that there's very clear mathematical single point perspective in this work. So it looks like a very believable three-dimensional box that these figures live and exist within. So it's very clear and very believable, which for looking at the history of art, that's a new thing in the 15th century. So it's, you know, really kind of, you know, a sort of show-off piece, if you like, for this time period. And then the other thing, of course, that we all want, and this is what makes the painting so special, is some information about the patron. And because the two men that look very similar here, who are Cosimos and Damian, are Medici saints, and we know that this is a small narrative piece and that it seems to be missing the rest of the scenes from around it. We in fact know it was for an altarpiece in San Marco in Florence, which was patronized by Cosimo de' Medici, and these are his name saints because of the surname Medic and the fact that Cosimos and Damian are physicians. So we've all these links and ties, so we can actually then match this to one of the most famous altarpieces painted in the 15th century in Florence and one of the most famous patrons. So just that little bit of recognition of knowing the use of name saints and whose name saints were who in Florence in the 15th century means we can tie all these other points of history together.
Yeah. Let me just reiterate for people who are listening who want to look at the image that we're speaking about. We have it up on our Twitter page right now, which is at RTE Arena. So you can actually look at the painting as Sarah and Jessica speak to us about it. You touched on, Sarah, just a second ago, you started talking about the figure who's up on the balcony in the middle. Composition is vitally important to this. You know, we have the fella in the red gear up on the balcony. We also have the group on the stake or at the stake in the centre in the foreground. The composition around that is very interesting as well.
It is. As Jess was saying, it's very beautifully done. This is all about symmetry and balance and using these sort of pure geometrical shapes, because Renaissance art at this period is all about creating a sense of harmony and balance and not just reflecting nature, but actually improving upon it and making it better. And if you have something that's harmonious, mathematical perspective, all these qualities were believed to represent beauty and truth. And and create this wonderful sense right. of symmetry within the work.
All right. So that's the first painting and giving us a sense of the sort of things that we might look for there. So we're now going to tweet a second painting up on our Twitter page at RTE Arena. And this is Daniel MacLeish, Irish artist, 1806 to 1870, The Marriage of Strongbow and Aoife. And this is a painting from 1854. Again, well, let's go to you on this one, Jessica, to describe what we're looking at. There are a lot of folks in this particular mm-hmm. painting. Big wedding.
Absolutely, and quite a raucous one as well, in that it's on a battlefield. so this is very much of its era of a Victorian dramatic scene, whereby they loved a sort of romantic story, but all the more better if you could turn it into something, you know, kind of over the top theatrical. So the organization of this composition is actually incredibly complex. It's also an incredibly large painting, 3 by 5 meters. Most people have been into the National Gallery will know it well, because it's just impossible to miss it, really. So within the scene that we're looking at, in the foreground, quite lit up, sort of well lit, we have fallen figures, and we have a man with a harp, and we have a woman with her hands in the air wailing. On the right-hand side of the figure, we have kneeling warriors, or on the picture plane, we have kneeling warriors. And then in the centre, where our eye is sort of drawn in, because there's a little bit of space that leads our eye in, we see a very pretty woman wearing gold, and she is holding the hand of a man in armor, and between them is a bishop with his hand raised in prayer, or sort of in blessing. And then in the background, we still have the battle raging on with a few sort of burning towers and all this extraordinary activity. So quite a complex piece, but it's something that is, you know, really fun to examine, because there is so much going on, and actually it really gives a lot to those who look for the details.
Yeah, and if we start looking at those details, then we're looking, I suppose, the great idea is, sure, all the Irish folk will all have red hair, stuff like that. Do we look? Can we spot Irishness, or particular, you know, signifiers or iconography that might suggest Irishness in this painting?
Yeah, no, absolutely. We do have some record that, in fact, both Strongbow and Aoife may have had red hair, but it is a very typical thing to depict the Irish this way. But there's actually very specific antiquarian details in this painting, because Daniel MacLeish was friends with people like Thomas Croker and George Petrie and all of these other antiquarians in the 19th century. And they were really interested in finding objects that related to the, you know, the cultural history of Ireland, particularly sort of pre-colonial one. And they went looking for objects. Sometimes they misidentified them. So one of the things we have in this painting is what's known as the Brian Boru harp, which would have been believed to have been Brian Boru's, but it's actually since been dated as a 15th century harp. It's in the long room in Trinity. It has broken strings, which is quite symbolic. But some of the other objects that we have are things like gold torques, the crozier, in fact, that's been held here. And they're all, you know, copied from actual artifacts that were found at the time that were Irish artifacts. So he's trying his best, but he does make some mistakes, because there are Viking tattoos and Viking symbols, and there's also African shields. So he wasn't quite there yet, but he's certainly trying to get the details correct.
And as I say, if you want to see the image, go to our Twitter page at RTE Arena, and you'll see Daniel MacLeish's The Marriage of Strongbow and Aoife up on that page. And I suppose, Sarah, those sort of things that Jessica's talking about, looking for the anomalies in the paintings, there's a little bit of fun in that for the art historian. And I suppose, if you were ever looking for a forgery, those are the type of things that might give it away. Little misplaced items or wrong ideas, you know, somebody putting a 20th century item in the midst of a 19th century painting.
Yes, well, I think they love this idea of adding in anything that might add to the sense of realism or the sense of romanticism. Mm. And of course, they don't always get it right. It's not necessarily designed to be historically accurate. You know, most weddings don't take place on a battlefield straight after the fall of Waterford. But it's to add to this sense of melodrama. Mm. And that's something that the Victorians really loved.
Right.
Daniel MacLeish belongs to a group of artists that we refer to as the Romantics. For that very reason, it's all about drama, it's all about emotion, it's all about adding this sense of realism as yeah. much as they can to the work.
Yeah, all right. Let us move on then to choice number three. And we'll tweet this image up on it at RTE Arena right now as well. This is Jack B. Yeats. Grief is the title of the painting. Are we really talking about Ireland's greatest painter, Sarah, when it comes to Jack B. Yeats?
Oh, I think he's a very strong contender, and particularly Grief. I would argue it's one of his best works, and certainly one of the major draws in the National Gallery.
So, give us the description then of what we're looking at here.
This is very different from the other two that we've spoken about. This is one that requires a little bit more from the viewer because it's painted in an abstracted manner. Now, it's not abstract. It is still based on subject matter. But it's the sort of work that helps if you just relax your eyes a little bit to try and figure out what we're looking at. Children are extremely good at spotting the details in this. So in the center, we have a fierce rider on a white horse, and he's raising his arm up. And in front of him, you have these blue figures that are streaming forward. And on the left-hand side, you'll be able to notice that some of them are actually holding rifles or bayonets, so they're soldiers. Then in the background, you can just about make out the gable end of a house with a protruding flag. Now, that house looks okay, but the houses to the left of it have not survived as well and are collapsed in rubble. And then there's red flames or streaks of orange suggesting fire. And beside them, a big black hole where perhaps a bomb has gone off, causing this destruction. In the distance, you've got the vague suggestion of green fields. And then in the foreground, you have two figures, a white-haired bearded man who's kneeling in profile, and he's raising his hands up to his face to catch a few drops of red paint, blood. And then to the right of him is a kneeling woman who is holding the body of a wounded or dead child. Now, I don't think this is supposed to depict any particular war scene. Yeah. I don't think it's meant to be World War II or 1916 or anything like that, but it's just simply an expression of the horrors of war.
The other thing that's really noticeable when you look at this painting, I mean, Jack B. Yeats, you think of the yellow, you think of particularly the blue, that dark blue, and the white, the wash of the white that's in behind, and that the mixture's in with the blues. The colours are, I suppose, tell us an awful lot about what Yeats is trying to do.
Absolutely. I think for artists, particularly those working in the 20th century, pure colour was extremely important. Many of them actually believed that it had transcendent properties, that it had the power to remove barriers of language, religion, iconography, social structures, because viewers would have a very instinctual and universal reaction to it. You don't have to know about Irish history. You don't have to know about Christian biblical stories in order to have a reaction to colour. Mm. So, for example, blue is, you know, many of us would associate that with grief, the title, depression, sadness. Red, the other dominant colour in the painting, reflects violence, blood, anger, and so on. But what I would stress is that there's a lot of room for the viewer in this painting. So what I see and how I react to it might be very different to what you see and how you react to it. And neither of us is right or wrong. It's very much an individual experience.
Just one final point on yes, because we are in the 20th century with this painting. No patrons involved here, just the artist wanted to paint it.
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the things that makes it really quite fascinating. This is just simply Yeats's desire to explore and convey emotion. And that makes it very unique compared to, say, the other two examples that we looked at. It's purely for his own satisfaction.
All right. Well, listen, fascinating to just go through three paintings in that way. I presume, Jessica, this is exactly the type of thing you'll be doing at the online course.
Absolutely, yeah. So we start tomorrow and it's an 8-week course where we essentially trace the kind of rebellion in art from the time of the Impressionists up until the Abstract Expressionists would be people like Jackson Pollock. So we're going to go through different movements, but also talk quite extensively about abstract art because this course is in conjunction with the Mondrian exhibition. And within that, we talk about things like Sarah was just mentioning of this sort of idea of the spiritual quality of pure colour and how if we take away the subject matter, art becomes more universal and we get this kind of spiritual connection between colour and shape and movement within a painting. So it's one of the things I love teaching because it does have this feeling that you start out almost like the lawyer sort of representing abstract art against those who say my 3-year-old could do it. Yeah. But it's actually really fascinating, the story behind how this happens. And it kind of really starts with, you know, the experimentation of the realists and then the impressionists.
Right.
And I don't think people necessarily know know that story. But yeah, we start tomorrow at 2 p.m.
All right. Well, yeah. This sounds very interesting indeed. But thanks for your 20-minute course that the both of you have just given to us. That's Sarah Wilson and Jessica Fahey there. And the online course that we mentioned, Art Appreciation at the National Gallery, is called Art Appreciation Breaking the Mould. Jessica is one of the teachers on that course. The course is tied to the work of Mondrian, which we covered on the programme here back on December the 17th, when we could do a walk around in the National Gallery. We were there with director Sean Rainbird. So you can still access tickets for that exhibition, nationalgallery.ie. The Pembrokeshire Murders, three-part drama series beginning on Virgin Media this Thursday evening. It's based on a true story of the Welsh serial killer John Cooper and the detective trying to hunt him down in the late 1980s and in the 1990s. The hunt was aided quite bizarrely by an appearance the serial killer made at the enormously popular Bullseye programme on ITV in 1989.
You've got an unusual hobby, John, haven't you?
Oh, yes, the scuba diving.
The scuba diving. Apparently, it's the place to do it down there, isn't it?
Oh, we've got the coastline.
Because,
yes.
Yeah, because yeah. Is it the mountains are sort of inverted and you've got all these...
Well, we've got the deep water where you can sort of swim over mountains and all sorts of
yeah.
things.
Yeah, we hope you all have a good night with us. Give them a round of applause.
Kind of creepy when you hear it like that. That's Welshman John Cooper in 1989, a clip from the series Bullseye, presented by Jim Bowen, who you just heard in that particular aspect. Cooper's casual reference to scuba diving belied a far more sinister strand to his life. He was, in fact, a serial killer. He struck once again within 30 days of that episode being aired, believe it or not. And the case has now been dramatised in a three-part television series, part one of which airs this Thursday on Virgin Media. Keith Allen plays the man you heard in the clip there, John Cooper, and the detective hunting him is Steve Wilkins, portrayed by Luke Evans. Mary McGill has seen episode one and she joins me now. Mary, I was listening to an interview that the screenwriter and the creator of the series, Nick Stevens, gave the other night. He made the point, if you wrote a fictional story and one of the plot twists said, so the perpetrator was on this programme on television where he played darts and he kind of gave himself away, you say, ah, that's preposterous, that wouldn't happen.
We just heard it, Sean, didn't we? And not only that, I mean, you said quite rightly, you know, he struck again his most notorious murder just shortly after that appearance on Bullseye. And not only was that his notorious, you know, most notorious murder, it also took place on, you know, this very scenic region in Wales called the Coastal Path. And as we just heard, he makes reference when he's chatting on Bullseye, scuba diving isn't his only interest. He also likes taking walks in the great outdoors along the coast. So, I mean, this is the most bizarre juxtaposition. You know, this guy who had been in jail or is shortly going to jail for burglaries, but has, you know, not been charged yet with murders that we, you know, he is responsible for. And you know this very quickly from the outset. But it is a fascinating look. And I think what's really striking about this series is a fascinating look at how you go about getting your man when you know you're like 99% sure you have your man. And you would think that would make it easier, Sean, but that's not necessarily the case.
And what we get here, essentially, Mary, is it's almost like a cold case because it has gone dead for, or not dead, isn't it? It's gone quiet, kind of given up on the further exploration of some of the murders. A 10 years time has elapsed.
Yes, so the show opens in 2006. So the Queen is turning 80. Tony Blair is still PM. Steve Wilkins has come back to Wales from a stint in London. He's a very capable cop, and he is looking. You know, he's looking around for something to do. And you know, this is a relatively quiet area. So he hits on these cold cases that haven't had their forensics reviewed in quite some time. And of course, forensic science has moved on considerably. But yes, I mean, the case of the Dixon murders on the coastal road took place in 1989. And when he begins to look into this and immediately he's confronted with some pretty conclusive evidence that links John Cooper to this particular crime, he begins, you know, he's a very conscientious cop. He's a very thorough cop. He's you know, one of the good guys. And Luke Evans does a great job of bringing this across. He immediately begins to link Cooper to at least two other crimes, one of which is a murder in the early 80s, 1985, and another is as recent as 1996, a very serious attack on a group of local teenagers.
Right, so let's
listen. So he goes from there.
Yeah, let's listen to a clip then from the new series. Steve Wilkins, as you say, playing the character of Luke Evans. He's played by Luke Evans, rather, the character is Steve Wilkins, who's the detective investigating here. Ella Richards is his investigating partner, played by Alexandria Riley. So they have to outline their suspicions. Cooper is in prison at this stage for a host of kind of small-time burglaries and things like that. So they have to outline their suspicions to their DI, their detective inspector, Lynn Harris, played by Stephen Mayo.
Jesus, Steve, is it him?
Him who? What's going on?
You remember Norton Hill? 10 years ago, a few months before I left.
A masked man with a shotgun attacked five teenagers near the Norton Hill estate. One of the girls was raped, another sexually assaulted. It was never solved.
I remember.
D.I. Richards and myself were called in to assist. The two boys knew about guns.
Yeah, they used to do a bit of rabbiting.
Their description of the shotgun that the attacker used exactly matched that gun.
Hang on. Back up a bit, Steve. The last I heard, you were looking at Coastal Path.
I was. Am. And that led me to this.
I'll ask you again, John. Regarding the murders of Peter and Gwenda Dixon on the morning of Thursday, the 29th of June, 1989, were you the person responsible?
I am not a murderer.
Strong accent.
South Pembrokeshire. What's this?
John, what about Scoverston Park? We have witnesses who say that you knew Richard and Helen Thomas.
My client is exercising his right to silence.
John. Come on, John, don't be like that. John. John!
Steve, ever since Huntsman, gossip has put Cooper in the frame for 101 offences.
I'm talking about just three. Coastal Path, Scoverston Park, Norton Hill. I think he did them all.
There you go. Luke Evans playing the character of Steve Wilkins, investigating officer there, and Alexandria Riley playing his partner Ella Richards, and their boss DI Lynn Harries, played by Stephen Mayo, in that clip from the Pembrokeshire Murders. New series on Virgin Media starting this Thursday, and Mary McGill has seen episode one. The music lets us know we're in a fairly dramatic place. Does the script and the acting let us know that too, Mary?
Well, it sure does. And I think for fans of true crime, I mean, what was just described in that scene there, Sean, was the indications of a serial killer, right? They don't come out and say it straight away, although they will later on. So we are very much in, yes, very, very tense territory. And this is, I mean, this show is, it doesn't break any new grounds, we'll say, but it is a very effective piece of crime storytelling. We get flashbacks to Cooper's life, but before he was sentenced to jail, we see flashbacks of the murders. Without being salacious, as sometimes is the case, we also see evidence from the original case, Huntsman, which was just referred to during that clip. So all the time, this tension is building, and there are conventions that anyone who is a fan of this genre will be familiar with, but they're used very, very well, and they do. After all, don't forget, we do know what happens, right? With regard to John Cooper, so you do need to bring people with you, and I certainly found myself very much drawn along to the pace of the story, irrespective of kind of pretty much knowing what was going to happen.
Yeah, and I did have a slight question. I mean, we've only seen episode one, to be fair, and in episode one, you're always going to have to do a lot of exposition. You're going to have to set the scene, yes, tell the story, that type of thing. But particularly in the early sections, there was a sense, I thought the actors did a phenomenal job with essentially, you know, giving out the information that we needed to know with not a lot of character informing it. It kind of was, here are the facts, here's what happened, and the characters were kind of mouthpieces for the story rather than being driven by something within themselves, which you would get in a more fictional piece.
Yes, indeed. And it is, it is, and this is testament to the writing as well, that can be quite clunky, right, when you're trying to tell audiences things that you don't really have time to necessarily fully flesh out on screen, but it's essential information. You need to get it across to them. And you could kind of hear in that clip as well, you know, moments where, yes, you could say that the information is maybe been a bit clunkily spelt out. That said, though, it never descends to the point where it feels very like plodding or unnecessary or rushed, we'll say. This, I mean, they do an awful lot. This is a 1 hour episode. They do an awful lot to really draw you in within 1 hour, which is impressive.
Yeah, I know. Let's have a listen to Keith Allen, who plays the John Cooper character. It's John Cooper who's in prison, and he's going in front of the parole board at this point. Mm. Now, we know that the investigation's going on in the background, and we know that he's potentially a nasty bit of work. But here he is pleading for parole.
You've been the model prisoner, Mr. Cooper. How confident are you that you can maintain this change for the better in the outside world?
100%, Your Honour.
One of the offences involved violence towards a woman. What can you say to reassure us that you no longer pose a threat to the female members of the community?
I'm not the same man that I was. The love and the loyalty of my wife has helped me with her.
Your wife has been a regular visitor, but your son Adrian hasn't visited you once.
I haven't been the best father, I'll admit that. Though I do plan to make it up to him, if you'll let me. I'm 62, Adrian is nearly 40, so... Craig says that a man is never too old to want his dad.
John Cooper, played by Keith Allen, pleading for parole in the Pembrokeshire murders. Mary McGill looking at episode one. We don't get to the Bullseye episode, the appearance on Bullseye, but I read somewhere that they aged down Keith Allen's face to put him into that for real, which sounds really creepy. So I'm looking forward to seeing that. The humanising, we heard about Cooper's son there, and the investigative officer played by Luke Evans, we get his whole marriage backstory. Do they humanise the characters enough here to kind of give it a bit of a fictional background as well?
They do sufficiently. I mean, again, Sean, you could argue that we're in kind of into trope and clunky territory, because would you believe this fine detective has a bit of a fraught home life? We've been here many times before. His marriage has recently broken up. He feels he's growing apart from his teenage children and so on. That said, I think it is still important to do that humanising and that fleshing out.
Right.
We know that John Cooper has a son, and that looks to be a very, very interesting storyline
too. So you'll be back for the rest of the episodes once they're available?
I think so, yeah. I mean, it's a solid piece of crime drama, and I think for a bit of escapism, if that's what you're into, this is ideal.
All right. Mary McGill speaking to us about the ITV drama, and it's on Virgin Media, Pembrokeshire Murders, part one of which will be aired this Thursday on Virgin Media 1, 9 p.m. And just after that first episode airs, the entire series will be available on the Virgin Media player, so you don't have to wait if you want to binge on the rest of the Pembrokeshire Murders. Almost it for this evening. Really enjoyed this segment on art appreciation while seeing the images, says Iris Helian in her tweet. Irina, love this combo of radio and Twitter. Dora Kelly, great idea. The RTE Arena Radio Twitter Art Exhibition. And so it goes on. You really enjoyed that sail through there, or look through those three paintings that we had earlier on. And lots of positive and lovely response to Enda Walsh's item earlier on as well. So thank you very much for that. That is our lot for this Wednesday evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields research. Jimmy Doyle was on sound this evening. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator, who's getting those images up on Twitter for us as we spoke. And tonight's programme was produced by Olin McGowan. Talk to you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock here on RTE Radio.